It's almost showtime at the state capitol as Governor Ducey is set to deliver his State of the State address on Monday. But a lot of work is also going on behind the scenes.
Taking on the 2013 State of the State address was without a doubt the most exhilarating, maddening, exciting, soul-crushing, you know, satisfying experience I'd ever had.
I'm Mark Brody. Today on the show, we step out on the ledge for 2015. Also, the legal reasons why Sheriff Joe Arpaio should or should not be held in contempt inside the Valley's newest museum and freedom riders on race relations in the U.S.
The job of all of us is to make those people who hate feel embarrassed about that and not to be able to exercise that.
Plus, coughing co-workers and investing in sports across the pond. That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Steve Goldstein. I'm Mark Brody. Couple spots in Valley traffic to let you know about. I-10 eastbound, there's an accident in the median at 7th Street. And on the 202 westbound Red Mountain Freeway, an accident at Scottsdale Road. Look for the sunny skies to continue throughout the rest of the afternoon. Partly cloudy skies, though, tonight with overnight lows in the lower 50s. It's sunny and 72 degrees right now at KJZZ. Federal agents have asked the Nogales Fire Department to screen 13 people from Africa for Ebola over the past few weeks. They are traveling from Mexico into the U.S. and were tested for symptoms of the disease at the port of entry near Nogales. None of the people had the virus. Nogales Fire Chief Hector Robles says his department is trained to handle anyone who crosses the border after testing positive for Ebola.
What the protocol is going to be is that they're going to be driven by ambulance to a designated hospital either in Tucson or in Phoenix. Once we know what we're dealing with.
Robles says Nogales Fire Department only screens people if asked to do so by Customs and Border Protection officials. Governor Ducey will keep four more members of Governor Brewer's cabinet. Ducey says he's retaining Health Services Director Will Humble, Environmental Quality Director Henry Darwin, Gaming Director Daniel Bergen, and Alberto Gutierrez, head of the Governor's Office of Highway Safety. Earlier this week, Ducey announced he's retaining the directors of the Departments of Transportation, Corrections, and Emergency and Military Affairs, as well as of the state's Medicaid program. Ducey also announced today that Jim Hilliard will serve as acting director of the Department of Economic Security. DES Director Clarence Carter resigned on Monday.
Doug Ducey gave his first speech as Arizona governor earlier this week when he took the oath of office. Next Monday, he'll make his initial State of the State address. Democratic Senator Steve Farley, assistant minority leader, will be attending his 9th State of the State as a member of the legislature. He says he'll be paying close attention to any specifics Governor Ducey talks about.
From the beginning, I'm going to be really looking to see how much wiggle room there is in his passion about not rescinding the corporate tax cuts, for example. I think it's been real clear that the reason we're in this crisis, a $500 million deficit this year, $1 billion the next year, and even more beyond, is because these large corporate tax giveaways have not delivered what they were promised to deliver. They were supposed to increase jobs. They were supposed to increase businesses coming to Arizona. They were supposed to jumpstart our economy. And considering Governor Brewer on her way out said it would be a good idea to suspend those corporate tax cuts, I'm hoping that he gives some indication that he's willing to do that. Because it isn't increasing taxes. It's just not letting, it's not digging ourselves in deeper when our hole's big enough.
Are your thoughts that you're really going to sort of think about exactly what he says and have expectations that because he says it, you expect him to follow through on that? Or is that sort of a thing, I'm making a statement to the legislature now and then everything is up for negotiation?
Well, I think he's going to make a general statement. And the real action is going to be when he reveals the budget next Friday. That's where you really see what he stands for. This particular speech is going to be all more about setting a tone for it. So I'll be looking for the tone. I'll be looking for specific things he says are his top priorities.
What sort of atmosphere do you expect?
I'm always hoping it's not going to be partisan. I hate the partisan aspects up here because ultimately I think everyone in Arizona agrees, no matter whether they're Republican or Democrat, that we really need to focus on balancing this budget, fixing our transportation infrastructure, making sure our schools are adequately funded, and our universities, by the way, even though I've heard those are on the chopping block with some in the legislature, mm-hmm. and making sure that our economy can thrive. And if Governor Ducey has ambitions beyond Arizona, as I think he may, that it's in his interest to be governing from the middle. And I think that's where most Arizonans want a governor to govern from.
There seems to be very little drama when it comes to state of the state. The one exception that I can think of is when Ron Gould walked out when Governor Brewer talked about the sales tax, the temporary sales tax. Any reason to expect there would be some sort of drama or anything inflammatory going on Monday?
I don't think that Governor Ducey is the kind of person who's going to want to make a major statement to offend anybody in this case. He's going to talk about how we're going to grow this economy and attract businesses and create new jobs, and we're all going to support that sort of stuff. But I don't think there's going to be a whole lot of drama here. But I think the drama is going to happen when we decide what his spending priorities are, because we've got a huge deficit. There's not going to be easy choices to make.
State Senate Minority Leader Steve Farley.
On the other side of the aisle and the Capitol Mall, Republican State Representative Justin Olson of Mesa, the incoming chair of the House Appropriations Committee, expects the budget and economy to be the big issues in Monday's speech.
Well, I'm sure we'll hear the same tone that we heard at his inaugural address, which I think was the appropriate tone. He balanced optimism and realism, recognizing that the state has some serious challenges that we need to address. But we're up to the challenge, and we can get past this, and we can create an Arizona that is dynamic and prosperous and growing again.
Would you expect the budget to be sort of the main focus of his State of the State, or do you expect that he'll touch on other issues as he did in his inaugural?
I'm sure that he'll address several priorities, but you can't get away from the budget in any year, and particularly in this fiscal situation that we're in right now. The budget is going to be the 1,000-pound gorilla in the room that needs to be addressed, that it, I'm sure, will be a major focus, both of the ninth floor's attention as well as the attention of the legislature. It certainly is the major focus of my attention.
How many details do you expect to get on Monday versus on Friday when the governor releases his budget?
Well, typically what we expect to see at a State of the State address is, you know, big picture, a few specific proposals, and then the details will really come out the following Friday when the budget is released. And so that's when I anticipate that we'll really be able to get down into the details to see how is the governor proposing that we address the shortfall that we're currently in.
Other than the budget, what do you think are some of the other big issues that we'll be hearing about this year?
Well, there's always a handful of issues. Certainly just a couple years ago, we addressed a major reform to our sales tax collection to make it streamlined for businesses and to make it more business friendly. And so we're going to have to address some of those reforms as some cleanup language is needed. The Department of Revenue has had to delay some of the implementation. So we're going to need to make that reform workable, both for businesses and for the Department of Revenue and for the municipalities. So we'll certainly see something along those lines. The governor campaigned heavily on addressing the wait lists at high-quality charter schools. I anticipate that he will be proposing something to address that wait list to make sure that there is accessibility to these high-quality charter schools for any student who wants to enroll in them. I'm sure we'll see some proposals along those lines as well. And then there's always some good surprises.
Republican State Representative Justin Olson of Mesa is the incoming chair of the House Appropriations Committee. So that's a taste of what lawmakers want to hear in Governor Ducey's State of the State address on Monday. But what's it take to write one? To find out, I spoke with Matthew Benson. He's a director with the Phoenix Public Affairs and consulting firm Veritas. Before that, he was Governor Brewer's communications director and was the lead writer on her 2013 State of the State address, although he says that kind of happened by default.
We went through a period of time without a speechwriter, and lo and behold, the State of the State was coming up, and so that was a responsibility that I kind of took the lead on.
What goes into putting together a State of the State address?
Yeah, gosh, a ton. It's a process that goes on over many, many weeks. I mean, before joining the administration, I'd been in newspapers for 10 years, so I had been a writer for a long time, and taking on the 2013 State of the State address was, without a doubt, the most exhilarating, maddening, exciting, soul-crushing, you know, satisfying experience I'd ever had, because you're talking about this enormous, daunting endeavor. I mean, it's thousands of words. It's a speech that goes on for anywhere between, you know, 35 minutes to almost an hour. It's a huge audience. Obviously, it's of statewide interest and concern. And so it's a huge platform. And the other part of it is that somebody's taking the lead on it, but, I mean, it's like a cast of thousands involved in putting that thing together.
What is generally the ratio of sort of broad vision versus specific policy proposals?
It has to be a balance. And, you know, there's no perfect percentage I could give you. I would just say that the state of the state needs to be aspirational. It needs to be lyrical in how it comes across. You want it to be something that spurs people and legislators in particular to action. At the same time, there's got to be meat on the bones, and you have to have enough details, enough substance there that people have something to latch onto, and so that reporters and media covering the speech don't come away and say, well, the governor didn't really offer any details.
Is there more pressure on a governor to deliver their first State of the State address? I mean, with Governor Brewer, she had done it a few times by the time that you had written hers. Is it different with Governor Ducey in this case giving his first?
I would suspect that there's always a tremendous amount of pressure. But for a new governor doing this for the first time, he's going to come onto that House floor and stand up there on the rostrum and look out into that audience and that gallery and see a packed room. That is something to see. And doing it for the first time, yeah, there's a tremendous amount of pressure there for him to perform and for the staff that's working with him and putting this together to really come out of the gate with something strong. Because for a lot of Arizonans, this is going to be the first opportunity to really hear the details of where he wants to take the state.
When you're going about writing a State of the State address, what are the goals?
I think at the beginning of that process, you're looking at it and saying, what headline do we want to be in the newspaper the next day? And does this speech, does it pass the headline test? And does it inspire legislators and our supporters, our base constituency and Arizonans at large to action? If it doesn't pass those tests, then it doesn't work. The governor just delivered his inaugural address earlier this week. I think it was about 25 minutes in length. Then it was a fine speech, but it's a very different speech because the inaugural address has a lot more room just to be aspirational in nature. It doesn't really have to get into the details. That's not an expectation of that speech. The state of the state is different. It needs to accomplish both goals in terms of setting forth a map, a roadmap for where you want to take the state over the next 12 months and over the next 4 years. So it needs to have those details, but it also needs to, for the lack of a better way to put it, it needs to sound good.
Matthew Benson is a director with the public affairs and consulting firm Veritas. Before that, he was Governor Brewer's communications director and was the lead writer on her 2013 State of the State speech. The lawyers representing plaintiffs in the racial profiling lawsuit against Sheriff Joe Arpaio have made a case for why the judge overseeing the case should pursue contempt proceedings against the sheriff and some top commanders. Meanwhile, lawyers for the sheriff are arguing the opposite. Joining me now to talk about all that is KJZZ's Jude Joffe Block. Hi, Jude.
Hi, Mark.
So remind us how we got here.
So Judge Murray Snow found the sheriff's office racially profiled Latino drivers. He's been ordering the sheriff's office to make changes to not violate the law, but the sheriff's office has repeatedly violated those orders. So late last year, Snow raised this issue that he was considering contempt, and he gave all the parties until yesterday to file briefs on it, which they just did.
What's an example of how the sheriff has violated one of Snow's orders?
So one key incident happened back in 2011. That's when the judge ordered the sheriff's office to stop making immigration arrests. But command staff apparently never told line deputies about that order.
So plaintiffs are saying that's cause for contempt. What kind of punishment could we be talking about here?
So there's two kinds of contempt, civil and criminal, and the typical punishment is fines or even incarceration. Plaintiffs want the judge to begin with civil contempt. As for punishment, they say the sheriff's office should help track down the people who were wrongfully arrested and compensate them for damages. Plaintiffs also say that there's likely evidence of criminal contempt, too.
What do Arpaio and his attorneys have to say about that?
Well, they're acknowledging that mistakes were made in the past, but they say that there isn't a contempt case to be made because the sheriff has made efforts to comply with other court orders. And it's important to note that he's not the only one. Not only Arpaio is in hot water here, the judge also named chiefs who may face contempt, too.
And you had the chance to talk to one of them.
That's right, retired Chief Brian Sands. He wouldn't talk about this contempt issue since it's an ongoing legal issue, but he's written a tell-all book called De Facto Lawman that's really critical of the sheriff's office. He paints a picture of Sheriff Arpaio being very consumed by media attention and fundraising ahead of law enforcement goals.
The sheriff needs to go. He needs to leave. And several of his chiefs need to be either replaced or put into different roles. And someone needs to be working with the courts, because this shouldn't be a matter of having a war over the rule of law. This should be a matter of trying to correct the action and get through the civil process on it.
So it sounds like Sands supports all of the court scrutiny and oversight happening at the sheriff's office. Is that right?
Yeah, he said he supports what the monitor's been doing, and he acknowledged that probably wasn't a popular position among his former colleagues.
So we have a chief here who's retired and is criticizing his old colleagues and boss in a book, and all of them may face contempt proceedings together. How could this play out?
Well, it's probably going to lead to a lot of finger-pointing. In court filings on Thursday, Chief Deputy Jerry Sheridan suggested Sands should have been the one to send the judge's order to deputies, so placing the blame there.
We will continue to stay tuned to this issue. KJZZ's Jude Joffe Block. Jude, thanks.
Thank you.
Coming up, from the world of sports, American team owners look to gain prestige but not necessarily a profit when they consider buying a European soccer team.
They do not operate according to normal business principles. You know, they can be a bottomless pit.
That's ahead. It's the show. Look for sunny skies for the rest of this afternoon with a high of 73 degrees, partly cloudy tonight, overnight lows in the lower 50s. Right now, sunny skies, 72 degrees at KJZZ at 220.
KJZZ is supported by ASU College of Public Service and Community Solutions. New name, new speaker series, innovation in the world's oldest profession, Tuesday, January 20th. Details at publicservice.asu.edu/talks.
More than 50 years ago, civil rights activists started what came to be known as Freedom Rides, desegregation efforts throughout the South. Two participants are in the Valley this weekend, Claude Liggins, who's black and originally from Louisiana, and Carol Ruth Silver, who's white and originally from Boston. Each was arrested in Jackson, Mississippi, and spent time behind bars in the 60s. I asked Silver what led her to join the Freedom Rides.
The overwhelming feeling that a great injustice was being done, and that injustice was being done in my name, as well as the names of all white people in America, and that this just had to be redressed.
Claude, what led you to join?
Well, my journey started a long time ago, long before the Freedom Rides. In high school, when I would read history books, I would always imagine myself being a part of some great event. And growing up, I ran across a lot of things that happened to me. The first thing that happened was when I was about six, when I went downtown with my grandmother to a doctor's office, and I told her I was hungry, and she gave me a quarter to go get a candy bar. Well, I went downstairs, and I decided to go into this cafe and get a hamburger. And I sat on the stool, and the man took my order. And then another man came in, a white man came in, and asked the cook, what was I doing sitting there? And he said, well, he's waiting for his hamburger. So the other man said, well, he shouldn't be sitting here. And the man who was cooking hamburgers told me to go stand up against the wall. And I didn't like that. At 6 years old, I could tell something was wrong. And believe it or not, I'm glad he did that because it helped me to understand and to want to participate, because I always remember that, and, you know, to help change things.
Carol, how did your participation in these events in the 60s sort of shape your life after that?
I would say completely. once you have put your life on the line, once you have made your will, as we were required to do before we were allowed to go on the Freedom Rides, once you have said there is something more important than me, and that is a principle that I'm willing to stand for, once you've done that, nobody can intimidate you about anything.
Claude, how do you think that race relations have evolved from the time when the two of you were doing Freedom Rides to now?
Well, there have been a lot of good things, but unfortunately, there's still some things. It's hidden. It's not as open as it used to be.
From your perspective, as somebody who participated in protests in which you ended up in jail for a while, what do you make of the protests that we're seeing now with relation to some of the situations between police officers and black suspects?
Well, you know, that's a touchy subject. I think what has happened is when there is police brutality, they seem to ignore it. And then by ignoring it, people come out when things get really bad. And if they would get rid of the bad eggs, it wouldn't be so bad, because it's not all of them. It's just a few of them.
Carol, I'm curious about your perception of how race relations have evolved since your time in the South in the 60s to now.
Well, the epitome of that was when the 50th anniversary of the Freedom Rides, which was a couple of years ago, was celebrated in Jackson, Mississippi. And a bunch of us went to a Safeway, and the checker, who was a white lady, probably half our age, but very spiffily dressed and made up and very nice and so forth, and she had a bunch of people going through. She kind of looked at the group of us, and she said, "Oh, y'all must be some of them Freedom Riders." And I said, "Uh-oh, are we in a situation here?" So we nodded assent, and she said, "Well, I just want to thank you." And this white lady with blonde hair and very much of the white establishment kind of person in Jackson, Mississippi, went on for a couple of minutes. She said, "I want to thank you because you got us out of a really ugly kind of life here in the South. I think that there are undoubtedly pockets of racism. There are pockets of hateful feelings among some people in our society, and always will be. And so the job of all of us is to make those people who hate feel embarrassed about that and not to be able to exercise that."
Carol Ruth Silver and Claude Liggins, two Freedom Riders who are in the Valley this weekend. They'll be taking part in a panel discussion tomorrow night at the Chandler Center for the Arts.
The American Cancer Society is estimating that more than 1.6 million cases of cancer will be diagnosed in the U.S. in 2015. In recent years, an integrative approach to treating the disease has gained momentum. Dr. Santosh Rao is Medical Director of Integrative Medicine for the Cox Center for Cancer Prevention and Integrative Oncology at Banner MD Anderson Cancer Center in Gilbert. He says complementary approaches like acupuncture and massage are part of a trend in cancer treatment.
They are becoming more prevalent around the country. I think that nationally, we first of all know that cancer patients are using complementary therapies more and more often. But even nationally, healthcare administrators are starting to realize that if we can save money and use therapies that are inexpensive and don't provide a lot of toxicity or side effects, mm-hmm. that's a win-win. And so there's some buy-in to this all the way up to the level of the NIH.
Was there a certain degree of backlash to this kind of thing that some traditionalists would think, well, this is really the way we have to do it? Or is integrative medicine something that perhaps we just haven't heard as much about, but it has been going on more behind the scenes?
There's certainly a lot that's going on behind the scenes, and we don't want to keep it behind the scenes. I think that so I'm a medical oncologist, and I've been experienced in the traditional part of care, and I think that there's a lot of very knowledgeable practitioners, whether they're naturopaths or Chinese medicine practitioners who also see cancer patients, but we don't always integrate the care that's offered by holistic practitioners with medical practitioners. And we know that a lot of medical practitioners aren't well educated on some of these complementary therapies, and vice versa. So it's a developing field. And the integrative model is seeking to find the scientific evidence for some of these very diverse therapies and finding out where they fit in cancer care models. And we want to do it in a safe way. So a lot of what we focus on is educating our patients and educating the rest of our staff as to why we would do certain things or why we wouldn't. There's a lot of things that have been purported to be beneficial but don't always fit in with the chemotherapy somebody might be getting or are not necessarily considered safe while somebody's getting radiation. Mm. So there's a lot of coordination that has to take place, and that's where it's really helpful to have people discuss this, learn from each other, and figure out how we can really incorporate this in a safe and effective way, because these things are, in my mind, very helpful and are being used. And so we should not be doing it behind the scenes. We should be discussing it and getting better at practicing it in a safe and evidence-based manner.
Santosh, where does mental health come in on this? How important is it to have that positive attitude we hear about? Because in some ways, there are cynics who will say, oh, that's a pipe dream. That really doesn't help.
We focus on it a lot. You know, everybody's different, and that's one of the ways we look at patients, is that we know that everybody's different, their life is different, social circumstances are different. We pay attention to all of those things. What stresses one person versus another? And in discussing these various issues with patients, their own personal lives, for example, how they feel going through cancer, we learn a lot about the underlying issues that are really making their life difficult and sometimes can make impact their ability to go through treatment successfully. So I do believe that mental health is very, very important.
Dr. Santosh Rao is an oncologist at Banner MD Anderson Cancer Center in Gilbert.
Phoenix Suns owner Robert Sarver recently attempted to buy European soccer team the Glasgow Rangers. Sarver isn't the first American owner to try and extend his sports franchise across the pond. The Denver Nuggets owner owns part of Arsenal in London, and the Boston Red Sox owners have a controlling stake in Liverpool. But are these moves based on business or simply a love of sports? To find out, we turn to Anthony Evans. He's a researcher at the W.P. Carey School of Business at ASU. So, Anthony, what's in it for American sports owners to try and buy European soccer teams?
That's a very interesting question. I mean, you've got a number of U.S. sports owners currently engaged in UK football. You have the Glazer brothers at Manchester United, Randy Lerner at Aston Villa. We had the Fenway Sports Group at Liverpool. And I think you've even got a guy who's formerly with the Denver Nuggets and the Rams, Stan Kroenke, at Arsenal. So, you know, there's certainly an interest there. I think it's very much a status symbol. The way in which football clubs operate is very different to U.S. sports franchises. But having said that, you know, the U.S. is probably the only country in the world where football, as it's known, rather than American football, is the main sport. This is the world sport. And so it really, really must be a status symbol.
Is it more status symbol than financial investment?
I think it's very difficult for owners to make money from football clubs. They do not operate according to normal business principles. You know, they can be a bottomless pit. The supporters continually strive for success and the acquisition of greater players. And, you know, quite frankly, I've yet to see many teams run according to sound business principles.
Sounds like, in some ways, American sports teams.
Yes, you know, in that respect, definitely. But as I say, the issue is that, you know, UK sports teams, European sports teams are not franchises. An owner cannot go in, decide to completely rewrite history books, pick up the team, take it to another location, change its name, change its color. One club, Cardiff City, was purchased by a Malaysian billionaire. He decided to change the colours of that team. 2.5 years later, after numerous fan protests, he's finally acquiesced and gone back to their historical colours.
Are there things about UK and European at large sports that American owners maybe don't understand? Because, as you say, with the fans, maybe you know the fan base is a little bit different. Are there different expectations on something about the team that isn't the case here?
I think the nature of UK sport means that you do closely align yourself with your local side. It becomes part of your family. It's, you know, it's in your blood. And therefore you take it quite personally when your team wins or loses. And you expect, you know, your owners to look after the best interests of your team. If Mr. Sava actually gets involved within a UK football club, I think he'll be shocked by the way in which fans react to him. They will be open to his involvement at the beginning, but if anything goes wrong in the long term, I think it's quite obvious that he will come under an awful lot of pressure, an awful lot of fan abuse that he certainly wouldn't experience in a US sporting arena.
Anthony Evans is a researcher at the W.P. Carey School of Business at ASU. Good afternoon. You're listening to the show on KJZZ 91.5 or KJZZ.org. Along with Steve Goldstein, I'm Mark Brody. In Valley traffic, an accident to watch out for, I-10 eastbound at 7th Avenue. That has the HOV lane blocked. Look for partly sunny skies for the rest of the afternoon and a high of 73. Partly cloudy skies tonight. Overnight lows in the lower 50s. Sunny skies over Phoenix right now. 72 degrees at KJZZ at 235.
KJZZ is supported by Mesa Art Center, presenting the Ukulele Orchestra of Great Britain, a plucky ensemble of genre-mashing sound from classical to pop, January 18th. Tickets and pre-show dinner packages at mesaartcenter.com.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. Three gunmen holding hostages around Paris are dead. Police say two brothers who allegedly staged a deadly attack at a satirical publication this week, killing at least 12 people, were killed themselves by French security forces today after they took hostages at a printing plant near the Charles de Gaulle airport. The BBC's Damien Grammaticus was there.
It was just before 5 p.m. Gunfire and explosions.
Okay, seeing flashes, more gunshots.
The siege had been going on for almost 8 hours.
Reuters witness.
Inside offices where the two men they'd been hunting had holed up. Together with them, one hostage. A violent end for the attackers who had killed 12 in Paris this week.
The BBC's Damien Grammaticus reporting. And a reported associate of the brothers who seized a kosher market was also killed. French President Francois Hollande says four hostages died at that scene. Meanwhile, President Obama is pledging support to the people of France.
We grieve with you. We fight alongside you to uphold our values, the values that we share, universal values that bind us together as friends and as allies.
Obama says he's hopeful the immediate threat posed by the terrorists in France is now resolved, though he does say the situation remains fluid. December was a good month for getting a job. The Labor Department says employers added 252,000 jobs, and the unemployment rate fell to 5.6%. That's the lowest level in 7 years. But wages are falling. Average hourly pay slipped 5 cents last month, indicating many of the new jobs are entry-level workers. Wall Street closed lower today. The Dow down 170 points at 17,737. That's down nearly 1%. The Nasdaq was down 32. This is NPR.
NASA will be embarking on a unique mission this spring. Astronaut Scott Kelly will spend a year on board the International Space Station. At the same time, his twin brother, Mark, a retired astronaut, will be on Earth. Both will undergo testing during that time. Mark Kelly, who's married to former Arizona Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords, says this came about after his brother was selected for the one-year mission.
My brother was going to be in space for a year, and at one point he asked the question to the public affairs folks, about a, you know, if I get asked any, you know, questions about science and, you know, the fact that my twin brother used to be an astronaut, how would you like me to answer that question? And it got some of the NASA researchers thinking about this, and they realized that they do have a unique opportunity. So they reached out to, you know, principal investigators from universities that have, you know, relationships with NASA already in biomedical type of science, and they found there was a lot of interest.
Is it something that the two of you had ever thought about, this idea of doing, being able to do research on one person in one environment and the other in another?
You know, we've thought about it, but, you know, for, you know, science with one data point, it's kind of complicated, right? Usually for, you know, big studies, you want a lot of data points, but they found that they could get a lot of good anecdotal information from studying the two of us. So, you know, they realized that this was a unique opportunity to compare, you know, two individuals, you know, who, at least when we were born, we had the same genetic material. People's genes do change some over time, but we've had pretty much similar, you know, environmental kind of experiences. So a lot of these studies actually have to do with genetics and how our genome changes and also how genetic mutations happen.
What will your regimen include? I know that both of you will be undergoing tests. I think your brother slightly more so than you, but what will your regimen be like on a day-to-day basis over this year?
Well, I think there's about 15 or 20 different studies, and I will make trips to NASA, to the Johnson Space Center, and to, you know, medical facilities in Houston. I've got one 2 weeks from now. I was actually there about a month ago. A month ago, I did a bunch of ultrasounds of my optic nerve and my carotid artery and my heart. They took 20 tubes of blood, you know, for all these different, you know, science programs. I'm going to be back at NASA about 2 weeks from now, where I haven't looked at the whole schedule, but I know it includes a couple of different kind of MRIs of my brain and an MRI of my heart, along with, you know, other things. But then all this gets turned over to, you know, these researchers, you know, around the country.
What do you hope that NASA and, I guess, the general science community gets out of this experiment?
Well, you know, one thing is, you know, we've routinely flown people in space for 6 months. We haven't tried a year yet. But to do things like go to Mars, or maybe one day to go, you know, to one of the moons of Jupiter, or, you know, eventually, you know, to other further destinations in our solar system in, you know, years and years, decades, centuries in the future, you know, maybe even leaving our solar system, we got to understand. I mean, we really need to understand the effect of long-duration spaceflight on the human body. So this basically doubles our experience. I mean, this spaceflight that my brother's going to be doing doubles the U.S. experience with a single crew member. You know, and eventually, when we send people to Mars for the first time, that's probably going to be a trip that is, you know, on the order of 2 years. You know, maybe even greater than that. So, you know, we got to build up.
Captain Mark Kelly, a retired astronaut, his twin brother Scott, will start his year in space in March.
According to the 2011 American Community Survey, women make up only 23% of bike commuters in Arizona. But one local bike shop is working to change that and get more women on two wheels.
Lauren Hayes is lifting her blue road bike onto a bike stand. She screws in a clamp, then picks up a screwdriver to loosen the pedals. But Hayes is not a mechanic. In fact, she's never really worked on a bike before, even though she rides a lot. On this night, Hayes is participating in Women's Night at Bike Saviors, a DIY bike shop in Tempe.
I started working, or volunteering rather, a few months ago.
That's Anastasia Schneider, who's co-hosting the night with Linda Kenzie. The goal is to create an inviting space for women like Lauren Hayes to work on their bikes. Hayes says it's time to learn how to fix bikes herself.
My fiancé is a mechanic, and he's taught himself over the last year by volunteering and then working in the bike station in Edinburgh.
Last week, when Hayes arrived here from Scotland to spend a semester teaching at ASU, she says she quickly realized that
in order to get around, it was really priority that I got a bike.
The bike she bought through Craigslist is working well so far. It's just a bit of a fixer-upper. The biggest problem is the stiff toe clips. Hayes keeps getting her shoes stuck.
Yeah, if I can loosen them enough to get in and out, then it'd be okay.
Women's Night was originally created by one of Bike Savior's founders, Sonny Nessler, who wanted to change the typically male-dominated field of bike mechanics and make it more accessible to women.
It's not that you particularly should learn bicycle mechanic skills, but that is one area that is very useful because it's related to a basic human need of transportation, and it's also something that women traditionally have less access to.
Hayes was the only participant last week, but Schneider and Kenzie hope it will grow. As for the toe clips that were giving Hayes trouble, it turned out they just needed to be loosened and oiled.
Hey!
Better?
Yeah.
But Hayes says she still has more to learn, so she'll be back.
Women's Night is held on the first and third Mondays of every month at Bike Saviors in Tempe. The Valley's newest museum is set to open next week in Old Town Scottsdale. Western Spirit, Scottsdale's Museum of the West, will open its doors on Thursday, although workers are still getting the building ready. The more than 40,000 square foot museum will include paintings and sculpture, but also saddles and pistols, among other objects. Tricia Loescher is the museum's curator. We found a relatively quiet spot in the museum to talk about its mission. She says it represents 19 Western states.
As we're looking at all of these diverse areas, one of our primary interests, of course, is to tell stories of the lives and the people who have been a part of the West.
How much do you think that the average museum goer knows about Western art, cowboy art, the stuff that you're going to be showing here?
Mm-hmm. I think, you know, there's a basic understanding, a general understanding, but what I hope is that we really, with the museum, make people want to learn more and ask more questions, and that we are a center where of communication, and we can have wonderful symposiums and outreach programs and educational programs for people to come here and with their general knowledge, or you know what they know of the West, firsthand experience, or maybe realized when they were on a trip or something like that, or maybe they live here, but to really broaden that out and help people explore all kinds of activities of the West.
Where do the works in this museum come from?
They come from collectors, private collectors. We do have a couple pieces from museums, but by and large, these are loans to the museum.
The placement of this museum in the Valley, I think, is kind of interesting because you're basically in the heart of Old Town Scottsdale, which bills itself as the West's most Western town. And I think for some people, the idea of the West's most Western town basically means like Tombstone, like gunfight at the OK Corral. How do you sort of broaden that out?
Well, I think that's what we do with our exhibitions and our programs and hopefully some of the events that we'll have, special annual events, but to really make people realize that the Scottsdale has a very long history as a center for artists. It's not all about Buffalo Bill or, you know, the people of Tombstone like Wyatt Earp, but there is so much more to explore and many, you know, different time periods of culture. So contemporary, past, future, the present, we'll be looking at all of those different periods in time.
What does the future of Western art hold, do you think?
I think the future holds all kinds of dynamic possibilities that, for example, our Desert Bloom sculpture that we have is a glass piece, glass and metal sculpture, and maybe a lot of people wouldn't think necessarily that that is Western art because it doesn't fit, you know, a cowboy with a cowboy hat, but clearly it speaks to the West. It is of cacti and the setting sun and the landscapes and rock and the terrain, so it's very much a part of the reality of a geographical landscape of a West.
What do you hope that visitors to this museum will take away from it?
I hope that they take away the wonder and the beauty of what makes the American West and question, what is the American West for you? And find yourself in the West is one of the questions we're asking. Where are you at in the West?
Is there any extra pressure on you or on this museum to succeed given the fact that this is a city-owned facility?
I think there's always pressure. There's pressure to succeed no matter whether you're city-owned or not, but we're determined to succeed, so yes.
Tricia Loescher is curator of Western Spirit, Scottsdale's Museum of the West, which opens on Thursday in Old Town Scottsdale. Still to come, how much sneezing is too much at the office?
It shouldn't be the job of a supervisor to play doctor and determine who's sick enough and not sick enough to go to work.
That's ahead. It's the show. In Valley traffic, two trouble spots, I-10 westbound, an accident at 27th Avenue, I-10 eastbound, an accident at 7th Avenue, each blocking the shoulder. It'll be partly sunny for the rest of the afternoon with a high of 73. Partly cloudy skies on the way for tonight. Overnight lows in the lower 50s. And cloudy skies tomorrow with a high of 70. 72 degrees at KJZZ at 248.
KJZZ is supported by Beach Fleischmann on behalf of the inaugural Tucson Jazz Festival, January 16th through the 28th. A 13-day festival featuring jazz music, food, and fun. Tickets at TucsonJazzFestival.org.
Chop suey, egg rolls, fortune cookies. You've probably eaten one or more of those dishes at your favorite Chinese restaurant. Chinese food, or at least the Chinese food that is so popular in the U.S., has become a well-known part of American culture. It's against that backdrop that the documentary The Search for General Tso is set. Jennifer Ait Lee helped produce the film, which draws a lot from her book, The Fortune Cookie Chronicles.
What is General Tso's chicken? General Tso's chicken is usually
chicken legs.
The dark meat of the chicken.
Best made from dark meat.
They cut about an inch square.
Marinated up with egg white.
Deep fried in a wok. And it's quickly tossed in the sauce. It's garlicky.
Tangy.
Intensive heat.
It's sweet.
Intensive taste.
Salty.
Outside little crisp. Inside still tender.
A glorious, sweet, fried chicken dish.
So, Jennifer, who was General Tso?
General Tso is a real guy. He is a Qing Dynasty military hero that played an important role in the Taiping Rebellion. He basically helped suppress this civil war that was started by a Chinese man who thought he was the son of God and therefore the baby brother of Jesus Christ, and basically fomented a revolution where there were 20 million people who died. So it's still the deadliest civil war till date. And so General Tso played an important role in sort of suppressing that and keeping China together in one piece. So he's sort of like the General Sherman of China. Like, he kind of used a lot of violence to keep a country together.
Based on that and based on his history, why does that make him ripe for having a dish, a common dish named after him?
It is actually really mysterious to us why, of all the different chicken dishes, General Tso is the one that sort of kind of reigns supreme. And I do think it actually is the anthropomorphization of this dish that made it beat like sesame chicken and sweet and sour chicken and orange chicken and, like, you know, lemon chicken. There are a lot of other chicken dishes in the Chinese American kind of menu. But I think it's the fact that this dish has sort of been identified with this sort of unknown, but still, like, kind of feels like you should know who he is, figure, Chinese historical figure that has made Americans sort of, like, relate to this dish. And that on top of the fact that, you know, General Tso's chicken, it is sweet, it is fried, and it is chicken, which are all things that Americans love.
What explains the U.S. fascination with Chinese food generally? And I also wonder that there's been something discussed, of course, for decades that this isn't really authentic Chinese food, so can we actually call it Chinese food? Where do you land on that as far as the Chinese food that Americans seem to really crave?
So Chinese American food in and of itself has become a recognized form of cuisine. Like, if you go to China right now in Shanghai, there is a restaurant called Fortune Cookie that serves American Chinese food, right? In South Korea, there is actually a chain of Chinese restaurants that also serves American Chinese food, which is distinct from Korean Chinese food. Like, Korea has its own version of their, like, you know, go-to dishes, like, you know, a noodle dish called jajangmyeon. So in contrast with that, you can go and get beef with broccoli and lo mein and General Tso's chicken in South Korea. So it has evolved and become distinct in and of itself, to the point where, you know, Americans, when they go to China and order Chinese food there, are often nostalgic for American Chinese food. They're like, I just want beef with broccoli. Like, I don't want any of this, like, you know, steamed fish or, like, crab or, like, jellyfish.
Is that good or bad that Americans have that perception?
I think it's important for Americans to realize that there is a distinction between Chinese food and Chinese American food. Just like they should recognize that, you know, burritos aren't really Mexican, or like spaghetti and meatballs aren't really Italian. But at the same time, the fact that these dishes have evolved to become their own recognized thing, I think, is a beautiful sort of byproduct of immigration and cross-fertilization. It's like when two cultures in all forms kind of meet, the most interesting things happen at the frontier and at the edge. And I think Chinese American food and General Tso's chicken is like one of the most awesome examples of that.
Jennifer Ait Lee produced the documentary The Search for General Tso, which you can see at the Harkins Shea 14 in Scottsdale. It premiered today.
If your workplace is anything like this one, hearing a cough or sneeze or lots of coughs and sneezes is not that uncommon. Nor is the comment from said sneezer or cougher, no, it's just allergies, don't worry. Nicholas Zebarth is a health economist at Cornell University and says when people go to work sick, not only can they not do their jobs, they get their coworkers sick so they can't do their jobs.
The main issue that we as economists are concerned about, or as public health people, so if people, we call it contagious presenteeism, when people go to work sick with contagious diseases, and maybe they don't even know about it, or they just feel like they're getting a flu, and then they can infect coworkers and customers. So that's actually one main channel through which infectious diseases spread.
Is this just an issue of people trying to be tough, or people trying to show that, hey, I can still work, I'm still a team player here?
So the interesting, in my opinion, actually, it's the fact that the U.S. is the only industrialized country in the world, actually, that has no universal access to paid sick leave. So it's up to the employer, or sometimes the state, to provide paid sick leave. So estimates say that about 50% of American workers don't have access to paid sick leave, and especially low-income service sector workers who have customer contact and may spread diseases.
So this is a situation where folks maybe don't feel well, but know that if they don't go to work, they don't get paid.
Exactly. So especially for low-income people, it's just a matter of money, because they have to feed a family, and in order to survive, they actually have to go to work sick, which is a result of not having any guaranteed paid leave. And in a lot of cases, 80% or even 90% of employees can take some form of leave, but then it's usually unpaid, and if you don't get paid, it may be tough if you're a low-income worker.
Has this become more of an issue in recent years, or has this always been a problem in this country?
It's relatively difficult to measure contagious presenteeism or presenteeism, because you have to rely on people's self-reports. And the other problem is that sickness is subjective. So some people have a higher tolerance for pain or for not feeling well as other people. So if you ask people, did you go to work sick in the last year, you may give a specific answer, but another person with the same symptoms may give a different answer.
Does this at times put supervisors in a what I would imagine to be an awkward position of sort of playing doctor, trying to determine to one of their workers, okay, well, you look okay, you seem okay, you can stay, but you know, you over here, you seem really sick, you should probably just go home.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, it's actually not, or it shouldn't be, the job of a supervisor to play doctor and determine who's sick enough and not sick enough to go to work, which is why you want to actually incentivize workers to decide on their own if they feel good enough to perform on their job, or if they may be contagious, and if it's maybe better to stay at home. So I think it's a matter of the work climate and having a good workplace and encouraging sick people to be honest and stay at home. But of course, on the other hand, also preventing people from shirking and calling in sick even though they are healthy. I mean, that's the other side of the medal, right? Some people fear that when you provide too generous sick leave schemes that people take advantage of it and call in sick even though they could work.
Nicholas Zebarth is a health economist at Cornell.
Thank you.
It's one of the most unique structures in the valley and among the first of its kind in the state. Today, the building blends with the others in the area, but behind this simple-looking structure is a lot of history. KJZZ's Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez tells us the story.
Drive past 10th Street on McDowell Road and you'll notice the Gruno Memorial Clinic. It's an office building with doctors, laboratories, and medical experts. It's been around for more than 80 years. Did you know the Gruno Memorial Clinic was among the first clinics in Arizona?
This was one of the first in Arizona where the doctors weren't in the buildings in downtown Phoenix, but we're out by the hospital.
James Garrison is Arizona's State Historic Preservation Officer.
Good Samaritan Hospital was developed diagonally across the street here at 10th and McDowell, and this building was one of the first, if not the first, to have doctors by the hospitals, and you came to see the doctor and more of a neighborhood setting than going to a high-rise building downtown.
The Gruno Clinic was built in 1931. Archivists' reports show the clinic opened with 13 specialists, a laboratory, research center, radiology department, and a medical library, one of the first in the state. It was created in memory of Lois Anita Gruno. The 7-year-old died in Chicago after a possible misdiagnosis. Her father, William Gruno, a wealthy businessman from the Midwest, endowed $1 million to create it here.
It's on the south edge of what we call the Coronado Historic District, which is more of a working class, middle class neighborhood. And one of the things he wanted medicine brought to all the people, not just the elite of the community, and that was one of his purposes for locating it here.
Its service wasn't the only unique aspect about this place. Originally, the J-shaped building was designed by well-known Arizona architect Lester Byron.
Very stylistically driven by the time it was constructed. There was the feeling that states, especially in the West, needed to have an architectural identity of their own. And it started in the West with what we call mission revival to emulate the missions of California.
The entrance facade and several of its windows are adorned with intricate moldings. Some are signs of the medical profession. The elaborate designs continue through the memorial hall, inside the main entrance. And high above, near the ceiling, on each wall, are four murals depicting key moments in medical history.
This is one of the premier Spanish colonial revival buildings in the state of Arizona.
The property has gone through additions and expansions since it was built in 1931. But the original building, its facade, and purpose continue today. It's the show. I'm Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez.
If you have suggestions or know things that we ought to know, please tell us about them. The show at KJZZ.org. Plenty of good stuff going on this weekend, including Barrett Jackson, the collector. Car auction kicks off tomorrow. Scottsdale Civic Center hosts the Arizona Vegetarian Food Festival tomorrow. And your last chance to see zoo lights, they'll be on through tomorrow at the Phoenix Zoo. The show is produced by our senior producers Sarah Ventry and Jimmy Jenkins, with help from Bruce Drummond, Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez, Tiara Vian, and Annika Klein. Tracy Greer and Maria Springs are our digital team. Al Macias is our managing editor. John Hoban, our executive producer. This is listener-supported KJZZ-FM Phoenix and HD. I'm Mark Brody. It's 3 o'clock.